Okay, we're right on schedule, and I think we'll try to keep to it. At our last convention, Gene Lozano and I, who are both Sacramentans, as most of you know, Gene was lucky enough to get us a historian from that city, and we found out that our first city was about the most violent place God ever created. So, Lord knows what we're going to find out today about the city of Long Beach, but to tell us a little bit about Long Beach, and his talk is entitled Ranchos to Renewal, we have Dr. Lionel Gatley, the treasurer and former president and founding member of the Long Beach Historical Society. Lionel?
Thank you very much. Whoops, is it on? Should be. Is it? Oh, we got to speak up close. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. This is a most enthusiastic group. I speak before groups all over the place, but this is the wildest that I've ever had here. And I don't know if any of you are drinkers or not. Well. Yeah, I knew you were wound up, but I didn't think you were wound up that much. But if you had lived in Long Beach, I'm going to go back to the beginning, but if you had lived in Long Beach in the 1890s, you would have had a lot of problems because this town was founded, and I'll go back to the very beginning, but I just want to tell you about this part, as a non-drinking, no liquor, no wine, no beer town. Incidentally, the Methodists were in charge at that time. But I do want to quote you one item from an ordinance, and I don't know about Vice Mayor Kell if you'd ever consider an ordinance like this, not today, but there was one in the 1890s which said, and you could not sell liquor to, quote, anyone having been notified in writing by a wife, husband, guardian, parent, or child. Well, there was only one bar in town at that time, but so if you didn't want old dad to take a drink, you could write a letter to the bartender and give it to him, and he wouldn't serve the drinks. I don't think that would have stopped us today. The area that we sit in right now, of course, was a giant blank piece of land back in the early days. The land, of course, was discovered by the Spanish. And the area, tremendous amount of area, thousands and thousands of acres, was given by the King of Spain to one of his soldiers, a man named Manuel Nieto. And, of course, in those days, the king, never having seen this area, simply said from mountain to mountain, from ocean to ocean, from river to river. And so he got the whole area down here. And, of course, later on, his descendants divided it up. And essentially, we are part of two ranchos here in town, Rancho Los Cerritos, and we still have the headquarters owned and operated by the city, and Rancho Los Alamitos, which is also owned and operated, owned by the city, operated by another, by a private foundation. So we have kept those to us to this very day. The ranchos, of course, had gone through many hands. But in the 1840s, a great number of Americans came to California. Of course, by that time, it was Mexican territory. And they became Mexican citizens, a man called John Temple, and another one, I'll tell you about Mr. Temple first. And he married into a Spanish family, a Mexican family, and thus were able to get hold of a ranch, a part of the rancho. Abel Stearns, and there's a street course, Temple named in Long Beach, Stearns Street's named in honor of him, he also came in. He had the rather romantic nickname of Old Horseface. But I don't think his 14-year-old bride mattered too much. Well, remember in those days, they did things a little differently. And thus the two ranchos came under the control of the two gentlemen, two Americans. And, of course, by this time, they had changed over to Mexican citizenship. And when California became part of the United States, their land grants had to be confirmed. And in the early 1850s, they were confirmed by the United States government. And thus, the ranchos now were firmly entrenched in Long Beach. And they operated sheep. Now, most people think of cattle, but they don't think of sheep in California. But as you drive north, there are tremendous numbers of sheep in this state. But down here, it was sheep, not cattle. You can do something with cattle, of course, if you have a large population, which we didn't. And so the cattle were slaughtered not for their meat, but for their hides. And, of course, we have that famous book, Richard Henry Dana, 2 Years Before the Mast, in which they, which he describes coming to California on the good ship Pilgrim, and then down at what we call Dana Point today, down the coast, they would throw off the hides, California banknotes. They were exchanging, of course, for goods coming all the way from Boston. And I see a couple of heads nodding out there, so you know your history. Good, I better not make any mistakes. opportunity, of course, for the two ranchos lay in their opportunity. They're in their business of selling the sheep mainly for their wool and exchanging it. But bad times will come upon the two ranchos. In the 1860s, a great drought hit California. And with that, and I don't mean just a one-year drought, but one of those seven-year, just like the Bible, 7 years of good followed by 7 years of bad. And these were the 7 years of bad. And the opportunity for the ranches, the grass dried, there was no rain, and they had to mortgage, and eventually they lost control of the two ranchos. But coming from the East Coast, but living up north, were a family called Flint. And their cousins, the Bixbys. Perhaps you've heard, if you're from this area, you know the Bixbys. They came down to Southern California, and in the 1860s, gained control of the by buying out the two ranchos down in this area. In 1882, a gentleman called William Wilmore, who was working for the California Immigrant Bureau, now. The railroads have come to California now, but as you know, railroads only make money on two ends, when they pick the stuff up and when they discharge it. In between, you know, you're not making any money just on the railroad, just going back and forth. And so we wanted people in California, and so they began an opportunity to bring over Europeans. They would go to Europe, bring over, and sometimes, particularly up in the northern area, the Great Northern Railroad, whole villages of people. And they would bring them over on the ships, put them into boxcars with their belongings, bring them to California where they would start farms and other activities. And William Wilmore worked for the California section of that. But when he saw Long Beach, with its Long Beach, he said, hey, this would be a great place for a town. And so he got permission from the Bixbys, and downtown in Long Beach, he set up a city. The city was to run along the ocean for 10 blocks, not very large, of course, in those days, several blocks wide. He wanted the street along the ocean, which is, of course, Ocean Boulevard today, to be the widest street in town. So that's why it's so wide. If you go down there, it takes a long time to cross it. It's 124 feet wide. He had other streets, a street that's now called Long Beach Boulevard. We called American in those days, and it was to be 100 feet wide, and also Magnolia, and also Pacific. He laid out his town, he laid out his lots, and he started to sell them. Well, there's only one problem. How do you get to Long Beach? I mean, there was no railroad at that time. There will be later. But so you had to go to Los Angeles, take a buggy down. You could get to Wilmington, another city to the east of us or to the west of us here. And finally, however, after a while, poor old William Wilmore, his dream shattered, gave it up. He'll eventually go to Arizona, come back to California, and unfortunately died a pauper. At one time, the city has been established now. They suggested maybe we should take up a tax or something for Mr. Wilmore, but it was known that Mr. Wilmore liked to take a drink, and as I alluded before, that was not going to happen. There's so much I could tell. We'd be here all night, but later on, when drinking was not permitted but was done. The police had a raid on the town later on, but they drank up all the evidence, and so they... Well, if you can't find it, you know, you can't arrest anybody for it. But so Wilmore gave up his dream, but his dream did not die because another company was formed, this time with a little backing, not only of the Bixbys, but other people in the area. And they laid out the town on the, more or less on the west side of Long Beach. The two ranchos were still here at that time. And the dividing line was a street called Alamitas, which runs at an angle up to Signal Hill, a hill we have here in Long Beach, where all the oil was produced later on. And as a result, another one of the Bixbys said, well, if you can lay out a town on that side, I'm going to lay out a town on the east side of this street. So what he did, he laid out a town, 20 blocks, laying them out in alphabetical order, A through T. T is terminal, which is Spanish for what? Terminus, the end? Okay, and he laid it out. Now, they've changed a few of the names there, but generally speaking, about 16 of the names still run in order. Falcon comes before Gaviota, you know, which is Spanish for seagull. And anyway, he and he also decided that along the beach, he wouldn't have names, he'd have places. So we have in Long Beach, first place, second place, third place. Those are the areas south of the... big street that we, you know, we call Ocean Boulevard. Unfortunately, he died a year and a half later, died a rather young man, but his plan kept intact. And later on, his family, a cousin came in, took it over, and this time named some of the streets, was expanding now, to some of his college friends. So we have Gladys in Long Beach, we have Raymond Streets in Long Beach. So these little things are... the water was to come from a large area that we call in Long Beach Recreation Park. And slowly but surely, the town began to grow. Well, we eventually incorporated. Now, remember, no drinking. No drinking. No, you can't have that. And so they, after, you know, finally they decided they wanted a hotel. Well, a hotel meant you had to have visitors. And visitors like the group I'm talking to now like to take a nip once in a while. And so they did allow wine to be sold. However, that little ordinance I read to you was in effect. But after a while, people got dissatisfied with that. They also got dissatisfied with the taxes, so they voted to disincorporate Long Beach, which they did. They would go to the county. Now, if you're from Los Angeles area, you've heard of the Sunset Strip. Okay, well, the reason, if you look at a map, the Sunset Strip is not part of the city of Los Angeles. It is part of the county of Los Angeles. And the reason for that was because in the old days, things were a little looser with the county. So that's why you have all those nightclubs along the famous Sunset Strip. Well, they figured that maybe even in Long Beach in the 1880s, that would be pretty good, or 1890s now. But they also found out that they had a county tax, and the county tax was higher than the Long Beach tax in those days. So in 1897, they decided they would reincorporate themselves. So we were a city, not a city, and then back to a city. I was at the airport Wednesday night, and there's a big mosaic on the floor, and they used the 1897. But how do you get to Long Beach? You can't get to Long Beach by walking. You could, I guess, but they did have a little railroad that ran partially the way. The only trouble is it ran from Wilmington, a city about 4 miles to the west of us, and it did get to Long Beach, but the only trouble is going uphill one way, you went downhill. Going downhill was fine, but going up, everybody had to get out, and so it was called a get-out-and-push railroad. And so, but finally, the railroad will come. In downtown Long Beach, we had an area called, and the mayor, Vice Mayor Kell, referred to it as the Pike area. Well, at one time, it was a great amusement area. And in 18, you remember that? Okay. How many people remember the plunge? Okay, I see some hands out there. And that was built in 1902 by a man called Drake. And he built this giant saltwater plunge. biggest west of the Mississippi at that time. And but still, I mean, you can build something, but will they come? So he persuaded, Drake had a long background of politics and other things, and he persuaded Coldus P. Huntington's nephew, Henry Huntington, who at this time ran the electric cars, the red cars, the trolley cars. And so in 1903, shortly after the plunge opened, the railroad ran, the electric cars ran all the way from Los Angeles right to Long Beach. Now, in the 1960s, that red car went out, but we have it back again. We call it the Blue Line. Now, of course, you can take the Blue Line just like you could take trolleys in the old days. You could go up to Los Angeles, you can take the Red Line, the Green Line, the Gold Line. I think the Gold Line or the Green one goes to Pasadena, one goes to Hollywood, one goes into the up there by the Olivera Street. Tremendous activity. But and things went along pretty well. The population slowly began to grow, but nothing spectacular. We had the beaches. There were a few areas annexed to the city. One of the areas that we wanted to annex to the city was the area down by what we call Belmont Shore. That area had incorporated itself as a city, but we had seen Los Angeles, the big city of Los Angeles, creep down on our west side and pick up San Pedro and Wilmington, which are actually parts of Los Angeles. And we were afraid that they would encircle Long Beach and pick up the other side of Long Beach, the east side now, where Belmont Shore is located. So the city decided, well, okay, we'll make a deal with you. If you will come and join Long Beach, we will build a pier. We had a lot of piers in Long Beach, but this will be what we call Belmont Pier today. So they voted to come in. The city council voted to sell bonds, and nobody bought them. Well, now what do you do? Well, finally the builder, one of the builders wanted the contract so bad, he purchased the bonds. Now, I don't know how he's going to make any money out of that, but that's what he did. Anyway, but in 1921, up on Signal Hill, we call it Signal Hill, it's just in the middle of Long Beach, we hit black gold, or we hit oil. And at that point, Long Beach took off. In fact, Alamitos number one, that's the name of the well, is still up at the top there. It has a plaque, and it still pumps. Today, the whole area at one time was covered in oil derricks, these big, tall structures. You may have may not seen them, but you've felt what models of them. Today, of course, they don't need those derricks anymore. And so, as a result, they still pump oil, but you can't see any oil wells. Now, the city of Long Beach did not include the area called Signal Hill. It would love to have taken it in, but the oil companies were very smart. They saw perhaps if this area joined Long Beach, what would Long Beach do? Tax them, yes. And so the oil companies had a incorporation, so they incorporated a city called Signal Hill. Today, because of annexations of Long Beach, Signal Hill is an independent city surrounded 100% by the city of Long Beach. Now, and of course, you could always tell when you were in Signal Hill because especially when you came up a street called Cherry, Long Beach had good roads. And as soon as you crossed the railroad track just north of Pacific Coast Highway, the roads just fell apart. You were in Signal Hill. And for many, many years, now, of course, the oil wells have disappeared. Now they can drill. There's a few. They're still pumping, but they can slant drill them and they can disguise them. And so it's rather peculiar to have a city inside of a city. So and at that point, the city took off, and the population jumped up. There were many magnificent homes up on Signal Hill, and there's one or two left, but of course they all went when the oil came in. I mean, if you had a little farm, what would you do? Farm it or sell it for oil? Well, I know what I'd do. I'd sell it for oil right away. And so we continued along, and of course then at the end of the 20s, the Depression hit. And in 1933, something else hit Long Beach. And that, of course, was the Great Earthquake. I was here at that time. I lived at 23rd in California. That's in the center of Long Beach. And it was a whacker. I give a talk and show some of the slides of that area. And for a week, many people, including my mother and father, we slept in a tent. You slept outside because the water and gas had to be checked out by the city. And after a week of sleeping outside, it was, happened on March the 10th, but it was a mild winter, and so gradually everything came back. That also led to a law in California called the Field Act, named for an assemblyman, which made sure that public buildings were properly made, not quake-proof, that's no way, you cannot, but quake-resistant to as much as possible. The buildings that fell down in Long Beach were mostly brick because the mortar in between was just like powder and, of course, were not reinforced. We now have reinforced our buildings and, of course, have a strict code concerning new construction. The World War II came by and, of course, the city of Long Beach purchased an area and sold it to the federal government for $1, the area down by our harbor in which they put the United States Naval Station and Naval Repair Station. They're gone now because obviously the Navy is not here anymore. And of course, with that, we've had to turn to other things, technology, tourists, conventions, like yourself, of course. And we're more than happy to have that there. And I've just been given a glass of water, which is generally the signal that time is fleeting from me. Well, it's cold, so maybe it's gin. I don't know. But the city is like Vice Mayor Kell said, is 500,000. But we've always lived in kind of the shadow of Los Angeles. But when, as she said, I mean, you know, when you compare us to cities that you've all heard about, you know, we're a good-sized city. I'll give you a brief part of the government here. We have 9 council people elected by district. And then the mayor is elected at large. And we have term limits. And Mayor O'Neill, after 8 years in office, was termed out, but she conducted a write-in campaign and was elected again. Sure. My good friend, Vice Mayor Kell, is also termed out, but she is going to have a write-in campaign to see if she can get elected for the third time. We allow that in Long Beach. And I don't know what your thoughts are on term limits. If you're in office, you don't believe in them. If you're out of office, then of course you believe in them. So it just depends. We do have these limits. And so the city is on the move. We have a redevelopment agency. We have an airport which needs to be modernized. I was in it, like I said, Wednesday night. A lot of controversy about that, but that'll all shake out. But we're more than happy to have you here. And I'm always mystified, but just wonderment at the dogs. They are just so. At our church, sometimes people bring the dogs in for training. And they sit and listen to the sermon. That probably put them to sleep, but that alone would calm them down. But so that's a brief history of Long Beach, and I hope that it's giving you a little more insight of where you are. And by the way, we don't have any problem with that liquor anymore there. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Gatley. This is great. Isn't it nice learning about the cities that we come to? This is a super addition to our conventions, so this is excellent. Okay, our treasurer, Mr. Pardini, wants to make an announcement, and so I'll turn the mic over to him.
Thank you, Jeff. I'd like to encourage everyone to, after this general session is concluded, to head out the back doors and right across from the CCB registration desk, and you'll see the CCB silent auction tables. We have the following items available for bid. And I'm not going to list the bids because I want you guys to head over there and check them out. The items are a handcrafted Bacotti wood bowl with a value of $75. We have a 3 foot, it's about 3.5 foot Statue of Liberty. It's beautiful. Has a value of $125. We have a knitted baby cap booties and blanket, which is beautiful. It's in blues and whites. Has a value of $25. We have two lap blankets, one predominantly in turquoise and one predominantly in grays. They both have a value of $30. Another item, we have four sets of knitted scarves and hats in various colors with a value of $20. We have a ceramic tactile pig cookie jar, which is beautiful, with a retail value of $40. We have a Sony TV weather band AM/FM radio donated by RITI with a value of $60. It's a great little small radio. And we also have a beautiful purple knitted baby dress with a value of $25. We have two women's shells. One color is multicolored and the other color is blue with a value of $25 each. And the last item is a Native American necklace with a value of $60. So please, after this convention, please head over to the across the way from the CCB registration table and check out the silent auction items. We will be there until 5 p.m. and also all day tomorrow. But you don't want to wait until the last minute because you want to check out the items, see what the current bids is, and place your bids on any item that you're interested in. All proceeds will be donated to the California Council of the Blind. Thank you very much.
Okay. No, I'm really fascinated to listen to our next speaker. I've learned a good deal about interior design. I think I know the difference between, say, a Venetian blind and a curtain. But our next speaker, is a blind interior designer. And I just think this is a fascinating topic. I'm very envious of this gentleman. And so rather than try to do any kind of introduction, I just want to hear from Eric, and if I mispronounce it, I'm terribly sorry, Brun Sanglard, home interior designer. Eric?
Hi. Good afternoon. Thank you very much to Eugene Azano and to the California Council for the Blind for having me here. And my name is Arnold Schwarzenegger. Okay, I thought I'd get your attention on that one. I am told, and I sound like him.
You do. Thanks for signing our bill.
I'm told that I sound like him. Actually, we're not even from the same country, so. But no, actually, my name is Eric Brun Sanglard, and I actually go by Eric B. for obvious reasons, you know. Much easier to remember. So, and yes, I design houses. I don't call myself an interior designer because I believe that I do much more than that. I design everything from landscaping to the architecture to the interior of the house. So I do it all. How do I do that? Let me start first by telling you how I got there. I mean, today, I suppose I should start with where I am today. Today, I have a base of clients who have some are actually very well known in the movie industry. I have currently I'm doing the House of Academy Award nominated movie star, and we're doing completely a new landscaping, pool, spa, outdoor living room. I mean the entire thing. I'm also working on another project, which is a remodeling of a beautiful home in the district, actually in the neighborhood of Hancock Park in Los Angeles, if you know where that is. And it used to be Francis Ford Coppola's old house. The house actually he owned when he was shooting The Godfather. It's quite an amazing house, and it's a great challenge and a great opportunity to be working on this project. So that's the kind of stuff I do today, you know. And on top of that, I'm also in the process of getting my own TV show on A&E called Designing Blind. Thank you very much. It's going to be a lot of fun because I want to make it a lot of fun. There is no room to be sorry for me there. I mean, I and that's one thing I don't do. I don't feel sorry for myself. Thank you. Now, I want to go back to how it all started because I wasn't always blind. I lost my sight 10 years ago from a virus called CMV, which stands for cytomegalovirus. Is that right, Ron? Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, CMV, yeah. And, you know, it seems some people know what it is here. It's often transmitted through cats. And it's about one out of two people usually carries that virus. And when you have a regular immune system, you are just fine. In my case, 10 years ago, my immune system was very depressed. And I used to have a completely different job. I used to work in the advertising industry. I lived between Paris, New York, and Los Angeles. I traveled a lot. I had a very busy life. I came back to Los Angeles one day telling my doctors and something was wrong with my eyes. When what kind of glasses would I need? And I found then I had this virus, and this virus probably would kill me within a year. You know, what happened to me at that time, I started getting ready to die, and in the process of dying, I lost my sight. So my story was different in the sense that I just didn't become blind overnight, or I mean, I was facing with dying, which was, to me, a bigger challenge. You know, through new medications, my immune system was depressed due to HIV. I actually contacted HIV at the age of 21, which is 21 years ago. And at that time, there were absolutely no medications, you know, actually. So when the new medication came out, I had the opportunity to stay alive and not to die. But, you know, I was blind. I was stuck as a blind man. And I couldn't perform my old job, which was my advertising job, the traveling. I worked in the perfume industry. It was a very challenging industry, and I used to design ad campaigns for the big, you know, perfume companies. So I couldn't do that anymore, and I had a beautiful home in the Hollywood Hills because I had a very good lifestyle and very good paycheck at that time, which all my money went into medical bills, I'm sure, as lots of you know. Yes. And I faced, you know, this challenge to have to sell my home. And selling my home was a very, very hard thing, but, you know, I had no choice to do that. And in the process of selling my home, I had made an offer on two small houses. One was very charming, but in very bad shape. It was located by Chateau Marmont in the Hollywood Hills, if you know where that is. It was a classic Mediterranean-style home owned by an old movie star, but in very disrepair. I mean, the place was painted all black. I mean, that destroyed the home. It was really, really bad. And the second home was a bad redo, a bad 80s redo in the flat near the Beverly Center. So I made an offer on both houses, and both offers got accepted. And I was like, God, what do I do now? And I decided I was going to actually buy both and fix up the one by Chateau Marmont. And it's what I did. And at that time, I had a partner, and we decided together. He had a background in construction, and he decided he was going to take part of the construction side of the project, and I would, you know, just design the home, which I went like. I think I never thought about it. I just thought like, oh yeah, I can do it, you know. And so I started doing that and using different ways to, you know, to kind of express myself, going, touching a lot of things, explaining things, using everything I could find in terms of tools, sometimes drawing things in the sand, sometimes it was taking some 2x4s and just kind of placing things around here, because I didn't just repaint the house. I mean, I changed the entire floor plan of the house. I built some new bathrooms, some new kitchen, did the all new landscaping, took a basement and made it into like a little guest quarter. I mean, did an old total number on the house. And that was the first project. The second project was that other house I was living in, which was a bad 80s redo. When we put the first project on the market, it was in the mid-90s. The market was not like today's market. And in the mid-90s, we had 7 offers the first day the house was on the market. And it sold for over asking price, some things nobody had heard of at that time. And I was like, wow, you know, something must be good. You know, I must be doing something right. So I did the same thing again with the second house, and same thing happened again. You know, this time we had 9 offers, all, you know, all over asking price. And I was wonderful. I mean, something is really happening there. So some things which at first looked like an accident, you know, became obviously some things that I had as a gift, as a talent, you know. And then went on and we did a couple of other houses. And what happened, the LA Times got a hold of my story, and it was the first time actually that the LA Times did a piece on me, and that was back in, it must have been 98, somewhere around there, 99 maybe. And people started calling and asking if I could actually redo their houses, which was a total, you know, turn of event, which I wasn't expecting at all. So basically, from something which was an accident, you know, it became a new career. Now, I can't tell you I went to school for it, because I've never went to school for design. I never went to school for architecture. You know, what I know is through my travels, through my like and dislike, you know, I've found certain things that, you know, I'm more inclined to use and not use. Thanks. Okay, sorry, I'm just trying to time myself there. What happened after that? I started a partnership with my friend there. We started a partnership. We developed a construction company, and I actually developed the design part of it. And we started doing houses for clients, and became quite successful about it. You know, from that point, I got even more attention. I was able to do a lot of TV appearances in different shows. I did a special for CBS. I did a special for NBC. I was on the TV show Extra. I mean, I kept having a lot of magazines and newspaper writing articles about me, which helped my business in a sense, and it gave me a sense of, people had to believe in me. I mean, it wasn't just an accident anymore. I wasn't just kind of this crazy blind guy just doing houses. There was something more than that there. the latest TV things, which was quite interesting and also came absolutely by accident, was Ty Pennington from Extreme Makeover Home Edition called me one day and said, "Hey, Eric, I'm doing this project in Florida, and we're actually doing a project for a family with the father is blind. He actually got shot, and I don't know if you guys saw the episode." Yeah. And he asked me if I could go down to Florida and to help them out to design a house for this man. And it was the first time I actually designed a house for someone blind. I mean, all my clients, you know, I've always been sighted. And it was interesting because it was very logical for me. It was like if I was designing a house for myself. So it wasn't too difficult in that sense. But it made me realize what our needs are, you know, and in the blind community are in terms of how, you know, different they are from someone else. And I think for Ty and for the crew of Extreme Makeover, it was a great experience. And I was very blessed to be part of that project. And that was really fun. Thank you very much.
You know, whoa, hold on. Well, people who want to ask questions, get to a mic.
Yeah. If I'm going to get to
call. I thought. Check that. Our speaker is not done yet, everyone. You know, so let's wait. Let's wait.
I'm going to continue a little bit here. You know, what I want to continue on is actually the experience that happened to me after, because it's important for my story. And I promise you I will tell you how I do what I do. But I think my story is more important for me is the fact that I didn't let something as horrible as losing my sight and almost dying and HIV and things like that get in my way. I took something which was apparently a huge challenge, something which was going to would give me the permission almost to become a victim instead to empower me. And what I've done is I took an handicap or a disability and made it an asset. Because today today I have a company called The Blind Designer. I say it the way, you know, it is. I have no shame around it. And if you go on the internet and, you know, and check theblinddesigner.com, you will find my website. So it's really all about, you know, just using, again, my disability as my asset today. What has been really difficult is later on during my career, my business partner ended up embezzling a huge amount of money from me, and which forced me to having to close down business for a while until I could get back on my feet, which I have now. But the betrayal was, I think, very, very, very difficult in that sense. But at the same time, once again, you know, I felt like that was necessary for my growth, because when I lost my sight, after moving from a very successful career in advertising and finding myself into another new successful career in home design, I never had the transition to really understand who I was as a person. And I think when my business partner stole from me and betrayed me and forced me to basically sell everything and restart from nothing, it really allowed me to find myself first. So what I want to say today, aside from houses and everything else, is the fact that sometimes, I mean, at least in my case, you know, the biggest losses I have had in my life have been the best things that ever happened to me. It really allowed me to build myself, to understand who I am, and to go on and to give me the strength to really prove myself, then there is no limitation except the one I put to myself. There is absolutely no limitation in life except the one we put on ourselves. And that's something I would have never found if none of that would have happened, you know? So. I want to tell you now quickly how I do my job today. When I go into a house, I really try to get a feel. First, I work with someone like Ron, who I call my seeing eye designer. And ask a lot of questions so I can get a sense of what I have to deal with. Then after that, I go in the house and again ask a lot of the questions, feel my way around, and use things like sound. You know, I'm sure you've all have done it. You tap on the floor so you can see how sound echoes in your around you, and it gives you a sense of how big a room is, what kind of materials, you know, they are used, from carpet to hardwood floor to cement and whatever. So I'm starting to get all of those pieces together. You know, I obviously use my hands as my eyes, so I touch a lot. My body is probably my main tool I use. I'm 6'5" tall. So if I extend my hand, I know it's exactly the same dimension. So I use that to measure everything, you know, and I basically use my body constantly to measure things. Okay. And then when you live in a house, obviously you have to move around, you know, correctly. So everything is, again, related to the proportion of my body, to the dimension between things would be in accordance to how much room we need to function into a home. So all of those details give me information on the house, if the house is well laid out or not. I call like a house usually like a Chinese puzzle, because I think it's one of those puzzles you have to resolve, you know, to really make it work correctly. Then after what I do, I have Ron draw a floor plan of the house, an existing floor plan of the house. And I found a great tool made by PF, which is a print in a flash. And it's a machine that raises lines, so I can put my blueprint through that machine, and it's going to raise all the lines, so I can feel actually my blueprint. And if someone is interested to look at it, I brought a couple of samples here, so you can... You know, we can pass it around and you can feel it for yourself. And so from now, I know and I understand completely the floor plan of the house, and I can start making my modifications on what wall I'm going to move, what window, what this, what that. And I work back with Ron, and I start giving him sizes and details and so on and so on.